me and the house as I bent over the box and lifted the kittens aloft. Cranium, 1998. A man and a woman are walking beside a river. The water is so slow-moving as to be almost currentless, motionless. They pause on a bridge, looking down at their reflections in the mirror-flat, leaf-dinted water. He looks at hers. She looks at his. She has been collecting acorns in her pockets, greenish-brown and set inside their cups, and as they have walked, she has sifted them with her fingertips and ascertained that, yes, each acorn will fit only inside its own cup. No other cup will do. The woman is me. The man is, well, never mind. They are talking about their situation, their conundrum. They have fallen in love, instantly, surprisingly, dizzyingly, but there are problems. There are obstacles. Other people stand in their way, other hearts, other minds, other situations. The woman puts out her hand to touch the dry stalk of a reed as she talks, saying something about, how can they? How could they? They could never, could they? The man reaches out to warn her, saying that he was once with a friend who cut his finger so deeply on a reed that he needed 3 stitches at a cottage hospital. A cottage hospital, the woman repeats. She has never heard of such things. She says she is picturing a hospital with a thatched roof, smoke spiralling out of a chimney, staffed perhaps by squirrels or mice in aprons, picture-book style. The man raises an eyebrow at her. They exist, I assure you. He hasn't, she notices, let go of her hand. They talk about reeds, about stitches, about times they have had them, because they need a break, perhaps, from talking about themselves, about their unresolvable scenario, about options all of which seem at once unavoidable and yet unconscionable. Still holding her hand, he lifts his shirt to show her a childhood scar on his abdomen. She sees a tanned slice of stomach, the waistband of his underwear riding above his jeans, a line of hair disappearing south. She wants to turn away, she wants to keep looking, she wants to bite him like a peach. She thinks, how can we? How can we not? This is a bad idea, this is the best idea, the only idea. She is looking for a private, shielded place. She is scanning for a way to make good her escape. The moment seesaws between them. Suddenly, a dog appears out of nowhere, out of the forest, popping out of the trees like a jack-in-a-box. It has a half-white, half-black face and a waving plume of a tail. It bounds towards them as if they are the two people it most wants to see in the whole wide world, circling them, leaping and yapping, its tail swishing from side to side, its face split wide in a canine grin. They exclaim, they bend to stroke it, to run their hands along its warm, furred flanks. When they walk on, the dog comes too, darting ahead on the path, looping back, diving between them, begging for sticks to be selected, tossed, rethrown. It thrusts itself past their ankles as they continue to talk. It plunges in and out of the undergrowth. It gazes up at them, panting, adoring, as if rapt by what they are saying, as if signalling its complete agreement. At one point, the walk takes them along a stretch of road. The dog trots between them, nose down. They hear the grind of a large vehicle behind them, so they step to the verge, still talking. A huge orange lorry comes hurtling down the lane, trees flinching away from it, tyres consuming tarmac. As they wait for it to pass, it occurs to the woman that she has no idea if the dog has any road sense. Some dogs she knows do, others don't. The lorry is almost upon them, when she bends down to put her hand on the dog's collar, to ensure it doesn't suddenly spring into the road, into the path of the lorry. She is acting entirely by instinct, thinking only of protecting this animal, who has appeared from nowhere, who approaches the world and all it has to offer with such trust, such unalloyed joy. She feels the mechanism, the powered steel of the lorry, pass near her, too near. The hair on her head is flicked by the side of the vehicle. She is sensible of the wheel arch skimming the top of her cranium. Metal at a considerable velocity, just passing over skull. A centimetre, half a centimetre more, and it would have hit her square on the head. The horror of this near decapitation rises like a tide from her feet, her legs rushing over her in a single distinct sensation. She could have died right here, right now, holding onto the man with one hand and the dog with the other. A minuscule unit of measurement in the wrong direction, and that would have been it. Curtains. Kicked the bucket. Carked it. End of the line. Lights out. Bitten the dust. Gone the way of all flesh. Given up the ghost. She has never been good at judging the correct distance between herself and other entities, knowing how much space she takes up, how much clearance she needs. The lorry zooms on. They are caught in its backdraft, the man, the woman, the dog, their bodies overcome by motion, by speed. She straightens up. She releases the dog's collar. She is aware of having dodged something, of having pulled her leg out of the trap once again at the last moment. She says nothing to the man. He does not need to know. There is already so much at stake. He is putting his arm about her shoulders and pressing her to his side, to his chest, to the muscle and bone nearest his heart. She rests her cheek against the woolen nap of his coat and breathes there, picturing the molecules of him, his scent, his skin, his clothes, his hair, drawn down into her lungs, along the pathways and tributaries of her bronchial tubes, her alveoli, dissolving there into her bloodstream and being carried away, sporing and spinning into the most secret junctions of herself. They walk on, along the road and back into the forest, where the light is patched and green, where the path is winding, diverging, not always clear. The dog comes too. Intestines, 1994. I open my eyes to see the French doctor from the restaurant standing over my bed, fists on hips, elbows bent at right angles to her body. I stare at her, astonished, wanting to ask her what on earth is she doing in my room. Has she lost her way, her mind, her key? Has she opened the wrong door? I can't remember how long it is since I chatted to her over breakfast, how long I've been lying here, ill. Days, certainly, spent prostrate on the unforgiving mattress or crouched in the narrow bathroom. But I have lost track of time by this point, lost track of everything. She reaches out and touches her hand to my forehead, my arm. I hear her say to Anton, whose face hovers in the background, fearful, dismayed, "She needs to go to hospital." Since I arrived here, in this small Chinese town, however long ago it was, I have been unwell, unable to eat much, needing to visit the loo with tiresome frequency, feeling enervated, listless, not sleeping. Then I was gripped by sudden pains in the middle of the night, and started throwing up. I couldn't stop. It woke Anton, who came and held my hair out of the way. What came out of me was streaked with blood, mucoid, meaty in texture. Something is moving within me, deep in the coiled channels of my stomach, something with claws, with fangs, with evil intent. It is gaining strength. I can feel it drawing it off me. It is as though I have swallowed a demon, a restive one that turns and fidgets, scraping its scales against my innards. I must fold into myself, breathe, grip my hands into fists until the spasm passes. And now here is this stranger, this French woman, saying I must go to hospital. It is, I decide, too much. I shut my eyes, aiming to block her out, and Anton and their plans. It seems to me in this moment that there is nowhere so lovely, so restful, as this painted concrete box of a Chinese hotel room. I don't want to go anywhere. I want to stay right here, on these peach-coloured nylon sheets, with the ceiling fan churning above me, with the curtains shut to keep out the glancing sunlight. Only here can I square up to this demon. Only here can I try to gather my resources to face it. I have reached that dangerous stage in dehydration, in fever, the point where you give up, where you just want to stay where you are, lying curled up on your mattress. No, I say, but I can barely raise a whisper. I'm okay. She has to go, the French doctor says, her words clipped but calm. She isn't talking to me. It must be now. They lift me between them. I am light, lighter than I've ever been, I'll discover later, even in my self-whittling teenage years, the flesh melting from me in a matter of days, and I cling to the peach-coloured mattress. No! I protest, kicking, delirious, furious, the spiked demon twisting within me. I don't want to go. I want to stay here. Put me down! Anton half drags, half carries me through the hotel lobby and out of the glass doors, where a rank of motorized rickshaws is idling at the curb. The Frenchwoman dematerializes, yet another savior never to be seen again. I don't recall much of the rickshaw ride, other than Anton holding me by the arm as I dry retch out of the open door. There is, I observe to myself, even through illness and pain, nothing left in my system. Nothing at all. No liquid, no food, no bile even. I am utterly emptied out. My skin is scalding, desiccated. It hurts to move my eyes inside their parched sockets, but still I don't want to go to hospital. I want only to be left alone. I realize now that what I had hit was the tipping point. My body, invaded by an amoebic parasite picked up on the Buddhist mountain of Ermeshan, had for several days battled for supremacy. I had eaten carefully. I had taken rehydration salts. I had rested. I had done everything you are meant to do when you get traveller's tummy, but this was something different. My fever was raging up in the 40s. I had been vomiting and shitting with increasing frequency for several days. Every last thing was out of my body. The amoeba was winning. What I thought I wanted was to be left in peace, but what this really meant was that I was giving up. I was ready to die, to abandon the fight. It was easier than staying alive. A Buddhist mountain. I had pictured a steep, mossy incline, hung with mist, a path through bamboo and Gongtong forests, a peak disappearing into sky. I had imagined pilgrims in robes, red-painted monasteries with plangent clanging bells, a scene from the calligraphic brush of a Chinese artist. The reality isn't far off if you overlay that image with hordes of pilgrims and tourists, some carried in bamboo sedans by porters, some in astonishing shiny high heels, inching their way up the stone-cut steps. The path is, in places, so crowded that it becomes necessary to stop and wait for the bottleneck to ease. The steps are uneven and ever so slightly too small for an entire foot. I have to watch every one, make sure my toes connect. Ermeshan is one of the four sacred Buddhist mountains in China, and the highest. It is, according to the battered guidebook that rides in the pocket of my backpack, regarded as a bodhimanda or place of enlightenment. It has no fewer than 76 monasteries, one of which was China's first Buddhist temple. The sacred summit is 10,000 feet above sea level, to be reached by more stone-cut steps. On a bus through the hummocked limestone landscape of Kunming, a man with blonde dreadlocks and a tenuously fastened sarong took my fingers in his and told me, with closed eyes, that the climb to the summit of Ermeshan is the physical manifestation of a koan, a paradox or challenge that leads to enlightenment. I nodded and, after what seemed a decent interval, reclaimed my hand. Anton is climbing the mountain with me. We have left Hong Kong and are going back to the UK. I am heading for London, where I am hoping to find work on a newspaper or magazine. I need to start my life. I need to find a path for myself, to find a job that sets me on the right course, or, in fact, any course at all. I have to find work that will pay my rent, cover my tube travel, and doesn't bore me to the point of screaming, so that I have the headspace and the energy to come home in the evenings, perhaps, maybe, possibly, to write. But how to pull off such a trick, such a balancing act? I haven't the faintest idea. So I am heading back to Britain slowly and circuitously, spinning out the journey for as long as my money will last. We are travelling overland, through China, through Mongolia, across Siberia, then Eastern Europe, ending up in Prague in a month or two, where there is a 24-hour bus to London. And there, the rest of my life will start, somehow. The Prague bus is as far as my plans go. I have no job, no home in London. I will arrive there in a matter of weeks, to sleep on a friend's floor armed with cuttings of articles I wrote for Hong Kong newspapers. I am, as I climb the steps of Ermishan, hoping for the best. When we are hungry, we stop at one of the monasteries along the way. The monks feed us noodles and rice, steamed vegetables, pale squares of tofu. If it's late, they will find us a bed in a dormitory or, if we are lucky, a wood-partitioned room to ourselves. If the humidity becomes too much, we dip our hands, our heads, into the ice-cold streams that flow down the mountain. Every now and again, we encounter a phalanx of grey-brown macaque monkeys. A Dutch woman we met at the base of the mountain warned us about these creatures. "They will fly at you," she said, "because they know tourists carry food in their backpacks and they will stop at nothing to get it." She rolled back the sleeve of her sweatshirt to reveal a set of deep scratches made by sharp, insistent fingernails. "You see," she said, and we nodded gravely. We did see. The monkeys sit in the trees on the tops of walls, lying in wait, watching our approach with intent, shrewd eyes. I remember the technique my sisters and I perfected with a particularly menacing black Labrador that lay across the pavement on our route back from school. I tell Anton that the only way is to get our retaliation in first, to show the monkeys we are bigger and scarier than them, before they have a chance to try anything. He looks doubtful. When we come across a group crouching beside a small pool, eyeing us with a calculating stare, I lunge forward, baring my teeth, stumping my feet, yelling at the top of my voice. The monkeys scatter like marbles, scrambling away from the water's edge, vanishing up trees, around boulders, over walls. The clearing is silent, deserted, the only sound the bubbling of the stream. "A bit much," I say. At the summit, we are woken in the middle of the night by mice that have gnawed through the cotton of my bag and are rustling purposefully about inside a packet of crackers. It's still too early to go outside and watch the sunrise. So Anton and I choose this moment to have an argument. We bicker half-heartedly about a range of topics. His refusal to stay in a certain hostel, my loss of temper beside a lake earlier in the week, how I'm always reading instead of talking to him, until I accuse him of being indecisive. We are off. We have the bit between our teeth. He counter-accuses me in a wholly unprecedented move of being secretly in love with my friend, the man who gave me the compass, which is currently stowed in the bag the mice have broken into. There is a moment of shocked, suspended silence in our panelled box of a room as we lie, not quite warm enough, in all of our clothes under a heap of quilts. "What," I demand in an unsteady voice in the middle of the night, in the oldest Buddhist monastery in China, a sacred place where people come to gain enlightenment, "makes you say that?" Anton is steely, numeric in his reply. "You write really long letters to him," he tells me. "You're always trying to find phone boxes to call him. It's odd, you being so close to another man." "How dare you," I bluster, stumbling from the bed with an outraged flounce, "accuse me of such a thing?" We watch the sunrise, along with a few thousand other people, who pose for photographs that make it seem as though they are cupping the sun in the palms of their hands. Then we catch the bus down the mountain, and as we travel side by side, mostly in silence, I begin to feel strange. The petrol fumes from the bus seem to invade my throat, the grind of the steering, the smell from the crate of flapping chickens across the aisle, the creak of the leather seats all conspiring to make me feel headachy, queasy, dizzy. Have I picked something up from the sacred mountain? Out of the rickshaw and up the hospital steps, Anton supporting me, my arm around his neck. Through the door, and we are confronted with a scene from Dickensian London, from a First World War film, from a nightmare. The foyer of the hospital is filled with people, literally filled. There isn't a chair, a square foot of floor or wall space that isn't taken up by a human form. There must be 100, 200 people crammed into this waiting room. People sit lined up along the reception desk. Others lie on mats or flattened cardboard boxes on the floor, asleep or just moaning lightly to themselves. Children cradled in the arms of adults wail. A man sits, his swollen leg propped on a birdcage, cracking sunflower seeds between his teeth, spitting the shells to the floor. Beside me, I hear Anton swear softly. We stand in the doorway for a few minutes, unsure what to do. Should we stay? Should we head back to the hotel? Should we take a seat or rap assertively on the closed window of the reception desk? A man in a white coat picks his way through the crowd and stops in front of us. He puts a weary hand to my forehead. He pulls up my lips as if I am a horse and examines my teeth. Stomach? He says to Anton in English. Anton nods. You pay? He asks. Yes. Dollars? Anton digs in my money belt and shows the doctor the wad of my emergency-only American dollars, ordered and collected from a bank in Hong Kong before I left. I hadn't thought I'd ever need them, had almost not bothered to get them, but a woman I worked for had told me I shouldn't go to China without them. Okay? Anton asks. The doctor nods, takes me by the arm, leads me through the maze of people. I am hooked up to a drip, using a needle from a medical kit I bought in Kowloon. There is a minor tussle about this between me and the nurses. I am given antibiotics to rid me of the parasite. Enormous mustard-coloured tablets I have to wash down with huge gulps of water. They flush out the amoeba along with most of my gut lining. In a few months, when I'm living in London, I will be sent to the hospital for tropical diseases because I am still pale, anemic, still losing weight. The doctor there will ask me what medication I was given, and when I tell her, she'll blanch. What? I will say. What's wrong? Those are only used here for... She stops herself. For what? I ask. Well, she frowns at her screen. Horses. I stare at her. Then I laugh. The doctor shrugs. They worked, I guess. I mean, you're still here. In several more years, I will be travelling in South America with Will. In a hotel room in La Paz, I will be woken by nausea, by fever, by an all-too-familiar scraping, clenching, serpentine pain. I eat a banana, and it passes through my digestive system in 32 minutes. I time it on my watch. I will shake Will awake. I think I've got another amoeba, I'll say to him through set teeth. Huh? An amoeba. As in amoebic dysentery. He will go out in the early morning into the streets of La Paz to find a pharmacy, armed with a piece of paper inscribed with the name of an equine antibiotic. Bloodstream, 1997. Occasionally, but not that often, I think about the person I was in my mid-twenties. I consider her. I try to recall how it felt to be that age. What were the frameworks of her days, the patterns of her thoughts? I am as far from her now as she was from her childhood. She is the median line between me and my birth. Sometimes it's hard to capture her essence, impossible to remember what it was like to keep forging ahead in the face of such flux and instability. Other times, however, I might be walking down a street with my children, holding one by the hand while trying to catch up with another, and simultaneously listening to what the third is saying about the Scottish referendum. My children have divergent and incompatible walking styles. One likes to lag behind, another to sprint ahead, and the other to walk right next to me so close that I'm often tripped by our tangling feet. We will be moving along in our assorted fashions when I will be hooked by something. The specific timbre of a decelerating underground train. A particular guitar riff coming out of the window of a basement cafe. The feeling of cold fingertips curled inside a pocket. And I will sense her as if she is on the pavement with us. There she goes, walking by, in her weather-insufficient tights, short skirt and bright blue trainers. She has cut off her hair. It doesn't entirely suit her, and bleached the asymmetric fringe. She has a pager in her belt, a book in her bag, and a lidless pen leaking ink into the lining. She walks fast. She is probably late. She needs a multivitamin, a square meal, a place to live. She has moved no fewer than 9 times since she arrived in London. She can fit her possessions into a single backpack. She gets sore throat, swollen tonsils. She stays out late, doesn't sleep much, fails to purchase even the most basic of groceries. She runs out of money before payday every month. She has recently left the man she'd been living with, shouldering her bag and walking down the stairs. The circumstances were dismayingly pedestrian, soap operatic in their mundanity. She had knelt beside the bed to search for a shoe and seen instead the loop and catches of a bra. She knew before she touched it. A flesh-coloured bra, not her size, not a style she ever wore, bought from a shop to which she had a particular aversion. A surprisingly practical bra under the circumstances. No wiring, no embellishment, and ingrained with the sanitised scent of fabric softener. The kind of bra that a sporty, organised, no-nonsense girl might wear under a smart blouse. A girl who does her laundry on a regular basis, buys clothes to last, and takes herself on healthy outdoor excursions. A girl who is, in short, her diametric opposite in every way. She confronted him, in a lowered voice, so as not to alert their flatmates to the situation. At first, her boyfriend tacked wildly. He'd never seen the bra before. It was nothing to do with him. He had no idea where it had come from. It was probably hers. Could she have forgotten she bought it? It belonged to a visitor. It arrived here by mistake. It must be his sister's. Pausing in the act of cramming sweaters and dresses and books into her bag, she laughed. Bullshit, she said loudly, momentarily forgetting the other people in the rooms around them. That, she pointed at the bra flung wide on the boyfriend's desk, wouldn't fit your sister in a million years. He stopped disowning the bra. He stood up. He got defensive, angry. He said yes. All right, there has been a woman. There have, in fact, been several. He accused her of always working or reading or sitting at her desk writing, or as he put it, typing. She never had any time for him. If she wasn't out, she was distracted by something else. He was losing his sense of self, his sense of worth, and he needed to find himself again. He ended this speech with the words, "I did it for us." This closing sentence has provided her and her friend Eric with much comedic mileage during the more boring moments of their jobs, of which there are many. They like to tack the phrase onto acts of an entirely self-serving nature. The more selfish, the better. Extra points are awarded for slipping it into conversation in front of a more senior colleague, which isn't hard to do because pretty much everyone is senior to them. "I ate a sandwich," Eric will murmur into his phone from across the office, "and I did it for us." "I bought some new shoes in my lunch hour," she will message him. "For us, of course." "I went to the gym last night," he will say in a loud voice, "and I want you to know that I did it for us." It has been 2 years since she got off the 24-hour bus from Prague in a damp bus station in London. It has taken her this long to find a job that doesn't seem like a cul-de-sac. She is working as an editorial assistant on a newspaper. She answers phones. She opens post. She calls critics to remind them that their copy is due. She tracks down the IT man if computers misbehave. She fetches page proofs. She checks captions. She visits the picture desk to find photographs. She tidies cupboards, shelves, in trays, chairs, desks, drawers. She does whatever people ask of her, and in return, she badges them gently, politely, to let her write something for the paper. She counsels editors, assistant editors, critics, sub-editors on the phone, in the smoking room, in the alcove by the photocopier that everything is going to be all right. It is a job with long hours, indistinct boundaries, diverish personalities, twists and turns of panic, steep learning curves, feverish in-house gossip, urgent deadlines, days with no lunch, and then days when she is taken out of the office for hours at a time by an older colleague who will ply her with expensive food, then quiz her about something that's happening in her section. Her days are filled with changes of management, made over everyone's heads, dry sandwiches, redundancy paranoia, coffee machines, security passes, rides in lifts, slews of bookproofs, late-night tube rides home at the end of press day, peculiar freebies, a reflective bag, paperweights with the heads of authors inside, Wellington boots that don't quite fit, chocolate toolkits, and once, out of the blue, an astonishingly expensive German fountain pen, which I still have. So, her ex is right in a way. She is out at work a great deal. She is distracted. When she is at home, which isn't often, she is usually writing, typing. She has started something that she is telling herself is a short story. Just a short story. It is, the last time she checked, more than 20,000 words and getting longer all the time. When she meets her friend Will for a coffee, they are friends at this point, good friends, very good friends, friends who call each other every day, who see each other once or twice a week, friends who perhaps take a shade too much interest in the ups and downs of each other's love lives. And he asks her what she's been writing. She tells him about her short story, her long short story. He looks at her in his penetrating way, narrowing his eyes, and says, "You're writing a novel." "No," she says, shaking her head. "Of course not. I could never do that. Absolutely not. Whatever gave you that idea?" Late at night, when her soon-to-be ex-boyfriend calls for her to come to bed, "For God's sake," she murmurs absently, "in a minute." The house is so quiet, the flatmates all asleep, the work of the story so absorbing, so satisfying in a way that nothing else ever has been. The words scrolling out from under the flashing cursor, the paragraphs opening out from each other like Matryoshka dolls. Then suddenly it's 3 a.m. and she's blindsided by exhaustion and exhilaration, and she crawls into bed thinking about her story, unable to find the path to sleep, listening to the sounds of the city waking up. She has waited the requisite time. She knows it takes months for the virus to appear in your blood. Does it hide somewhere, she wonders, like a pantomime villain, behind a door, up a chimney, in the leaves of a tree? As with anyone who grew up in the 1980s, she knows the rules, the risks, the causes. She still remembers the grim governmental warnings on TV, with falling tombstones and rock-flaying chisels. So she is taking herself off to a clinic for the blood test. Not a prospect to relish, this, but something to be got through. She wants to be sure that her ex-boyfriend hasn't passed anything on to her, hasn't deposited anything sinister in her bloodstream. She has persuaded Eric to come with her, to get tested alongside her. Eric walks the distance from the tube station to the clinic door, talking, gesturing, tugging at the ends of her scarf. At the clinic, there is an administrative fluster. The receptionist cannot countenance that Eric has arrived without an appointment. "The thing is," he said, snatching off his sunglasses, "my need is greater than hers." She sees the receptionist about to argue, to insist, to stick to her guidelines and to deny him a test. But then she sees her look at Eric properly, and for the first time. There is a slight pause. The receptionist nods, finally, to the pile of forms, and they walk away together towards the waiting area. "Write down a list of the people you have slept with in the past 5 years," Eric reads aloud from the form. A little too aloud. "Do you think you're allowed to ask for extra paper? Like in an exam?" "Shh," she says, and he is saying an affronted, "What?" And she's trying not to laugh because it seems a sacrilegious thing to do here, in a sexual health clinic, where other people are sitting with their heads bowed, avoiding each other's eyes, working their way through these labyrinthine forms. Eric sighs, fidgets, says they need to line up some sort of treat for afterwards. "What if you don't know their names?" he is asking, tapping his pen on the clipboard. "Do you just write man one, man two? Or, if I'm being brutally honest, man 99, man 100? At that moment, someone calls her name and she gets up, lifting her clipboard, and walks towards a woman in a green overall. Eric is behind her, hissing that he isn't going to let her forget she made him do this, that she put him through it, even though she knows how much he hates needles. She moves in her blue trainers over the carpet, and as she does so, she considers the gravity of the possible outcome. Could it be that her ex has passed on something destructive, something stealthy and corroding? that his body scooped up something from the wearer of the flesh-coloured bra, or one of the others, and deposited it in hers. She hasn't allowed herself to dwell on who these women were, whether she knows them, whether they looked at her clothes draped on the chair, her books stacked up beside the bed, her makeup and toothbrush in the bathroom, the photos on the walls of her sisters, her nieces, her coat hanging by the door, whether they thought, "I wonder who she is." She tries not to imagine them, what they look like, how he touched them, what they might have said together, how he could not have said anything the first time it happened, how he could turn from them to her without giving himself away. Infidelity is as old as humanity. There is nothing about it you can think or say that hasn't been thought or said before. You go back and back over the days, the conversations, the walks you took, wondering why on earth you hadn't seen it, how you could have missed it, how you could not have known. The pain of it is interior, humiliating, infinitely wearying. She knows this, Eric knows this. It's why they joke about it all day long, with a gleeful irreverence that probably annoys everyone else in earshot. Sometimes being flippant is the only way forward, the only way to get through. Perhaps this attitude, however, has been preventing her from entertaining the possibility that these tests might be positive. She realizes this as she walks towards the nurse. She made this appointment mostly for show, so she could tell Eric as she dialed the number, so he could listen as she made the appointment, so she could say to him as she headed out from work, "Why don't you come too? You could keep me company. We could take the blood test together." She is on a tightrope as she makes her way to the consulting room, Eric behind her, the nurse in front. What, she is asking herself, will she do if something comes up on this test? If her show appointment turns out to be needed after all? She tries out the scenario of going round to see her ex. She thinks about taking the tube and walking the very familiar route past the cricket ground, across the bus terminus, ascending the stairs to the door whose threshold she swore she'd never cross again, and saying, "What exactly? I need to talk to you. I've got some news for you." What would anyone say in these situations? How do you broach such a subject? But mostly as she rolls up her sleeve as she makes a fist as she turns her head away, because she never likes to see the needle slide in, the flesh yield beneath its point. She's not thinking about her ex or the other women or the flat they used to share. She's not thinking about the plants she had to abandon there, plants she's sure he never waters, the walls she painted, the curtains she installed, standing precariously on a stepladder to do so. She's thinking about Eric, about his ochre-tinged skin, the cornflake-sized scab on his face that won't heal, the opal-pale moons of his fingernails as he types across the office from her. She is seized with an irrational urge to say to the nurse, "Make it all right. Please, for him, make it okay." Cause Unknown, 2003. There is no getting around it. The baby is in earnest, his cries coming thicker and faster. He is writhing around within the confines of his car seat, his face screwed up and scarlet with hunger, with need. "Can you pull over?" I murmur. We are on a long, deserted stretch of French road. On one side is a thicket of maize, unmoving in the still, heated air. On the other, a wide stretch of sea, some dunes covered with scrubby, dense undergrowth. Will steers the car to the verge, pulls up the handbrake. I squeeze through the seats to retrieve the baby from the back seat, and Will says, "I'll just walk down to the sea for a bit." I'm negotiating the fastenings of an unfamiliar baby seat, easing tiny, angry limbs out of black straps, cradling the vulnerable skull of my son, making sure I don't drop him as I lever myself back into the passenger seat. So I'm not really thinking about what Will has just said when I say fine. The baby is furious, ravenous, fists and legs pumping with outrage. I am grappling, juggling, really, with my shirt buttons, the clips of my feeding bra, a muslin square, a breast pad. It is hot and the baby and I are sweaty, slick. Quite a skill, this, the tessellation of two body parts, the docking of jaw with breast. I still haven't got the hang of it, not yet. I have watched others do it, in cafes, on buses, in the fitting rooms of shops. The smooth upward motion of it, their lack of fuss, their ease, the way their babies don't seem to move or twist, happy to remain there, peacefully feeding, and I stare at them, covert, envious, wondering how they do it, how they pull it off, and will I ever be as good as that? I never seem to get it quite right, always seem to be ham-fisted, flustered, my son slippery as an eel in my novice grasp. We give it a try, and the baby is so desperate, he goes for it with a sudden snapping pounce. My hands curl with pain. There is no one to hear me cry out. I press my fingers to my forehead, hum to myself, wait for the agony to pass. We are in France for 2 weeks. I'm not sure what impulse drove me to book a holiday when my baby would be only 9 weeks old, but that was back in the before, when I was still pregnant, when I had imagined wafting about in the summer heat, a baby on my hip, seeing friends, visiting galleries, reading, perhaps working, going about my life undisturbed. The truth is that my life is nothing like this. The truth is that I am not doing so well. I am having trouble keeping my head above water. I did not have the natural birth we all dream of in a quiet, dark room at home, labouring away, aided only by spritzes of essential oils and soft-voiced doulas. I had a series of interventions in an understaffed, overlit hospital ward, a long and frightening labour that went on for days and nights, then an emergency C-section that went awry. The baby became stuck, his heart rate dropped. I lost a lot of blood. I was patched up and sent home. The truth is that, just over 2 months ago, this baby and I nearly died. The resulting scar across my abdomen looks, according to my sister, like a shark bite. The truth is that I cannot sleep, even when the baby isn't feeding. When I do manage to sleep, on the sofa sitting up in a chair, I am beset by short, frantic dreams where someone is committing violence upon me, upon my baby, or dreams where someone has wrenched him from my arms, or where I look over at the Moses basket or the pram and it's empty. I try to walk upstairs and find that I can't, my head swimming and fizzing on the sixth or seventh step. I can't wander to the park. I can't drag myself along the road to the shop. My son and I regard each other in the shaded 2 ground-floor rooms of our flat while a heat wave surges around the outside walls. My friends come round, and it's as if I can't hear them, as if they're behind glass or under a body of water. They seem so far away, sitting across the room. How was the bath? People ask, a kind and eager look on their faces. And I have no idea what to say. The feeding goes on all day, all night. The baby seems hungry, but halfway through he will rear back, his knees drawn up, his face contorted with pain, with dismay, and then he will howl, he will scream, he will yell for hours and hours until it's time to feed him again. Something is wrong, I know. Maybe it's me. Maybe my milk is no good, too much, or not enough. Maybe I'm not doing this right. Maybe I'm just rubbish at it. But I'm so wary of doctors, of forms, of hospitals, so rehearsed in the way they can suck you in, chew you up, and not spit you out for a long time, that when I see the health visitor, I pull my face into a smile and say, "Everything's fine. Yes, all good. No, I don't cry more than usual. Yes, he's wonderful. Yes, he sleeps. Yes, I'm absolutely fine." In several months' time, I will be at a doctor's surgery in the town where I grew up, waiting for my mother to come out of an appointment, and I will be trying to feed my son. He will be doing his stopping and starting, his rearing, his screaming, his writhing, his knee jerks. I will be doing my back patting, my moving around, my latching him on in an upright position, and I will walk back and forth while I do this, because he can only feed if he's in motion. I will be clutching his now considerable 6-month-old form as I pace up and down, turning and turning when I meet a wall, like a long-distance swimmer. A woman will walk by, regarding us with sidelong interest. I will ignore her, trying to soothe my child, lugging him from one wall to another, coaxing him back on the breast. She will walk by us again, giving me a smile. "Hello," she will say. "I'm a breastfeeding counsellor. Does your baby always feed like this?" I will answer by bursting into tears. Within seconds, I am in her office and she's holding my son. I'm trying to explain that I am not a patient at this practice, that I live in London, that I'm only here with my mother, but the woman is shrugging, smiling, saying it doesn't matter. She asks me about my son, and I tell her that he starts well but then jerks back. He seems to get a sudden pain halfway through. I tell her I have to feed him at home always because we can't do it in public. And I have to unplug the phone and disable the doorbell because any noise at all can disturb him and cause hours of screaming. I tell her all of this, which for me seems normal, but the act of speaking it makes me realize that it's not normal at all.
So you stay at home with him?
Yes. Just for feeds or between feeds as well?
I think about this.
Well, between feeds he's usually crying. I nod.
So you feed him or try to feed him, then he cries, and after that?
I try to feed him again. She bounces him up and down on her knee, making him smile, making him grab for her necklaces.
Does he bring the milk back up?
I shake my head.
I think, she says to him, and he listens to her, rapt. You've got gastroesophageal reflux.
They sometimes call it silent reflux, but I don't know why, because it's anything but. The bad news is that there's nothing you can do about it, but the good news is that it goes away by itself at around 6 months, and I would say... She lifts him high in the air.
You're almost there.
She waggles her head from side to side.
So you're going to be fine, more than fine. The question now, she still addresses him, is what we're going to do about Mummy.
Because Mummy's been doing a wonderful job looking after you, but now she needs a bit of help too, doesn't she?
But this is all to come. Right now, my son is 9 weeks old and I'm finding my way, blundering forward with this new job, this new life.
Right now, I'm in France, for reasons that are no longer clear to me, trying to breastfeed in a hot car by the side of the road. Right now, Will has disappeared over the dunes to look at the sea, and two men are rustling their way out of the maize field on the other side of the road. I see them from a long way off. My son has finally settled to the feed, and I'm holding myself as still as possible so as not to disturb him, so as not to set off one of his episodes of pain and screaming. They are carrying bedding rolls on their backs. Their clothes are torn, sun-bleached, their skins tanned brown. One has peroxide white hair, the other a straggly ponytail. They are looking at the car, conferring, deciding. They cross the road without looking because it is the kind of road where you can do that. Empty, quiet, deserted. I watch their approach along the dusty asphalt. They are straight ahead of me now, obscuring the vanishing point. I glance over towards the beach. Where is Will? Can he see them coming? Would he hear me if I called? There is no sign of him. The men are getting closer. They are walking faster. Their eyes bore into me, into the car. One is wearing flip-flops. The other walks in bare soles over the hot road. I cast my eyes towards the ignition. Could I simply drive away? Lay my baby on the seat and hit the accelerator, come back for Will later. The ignition is empty. Will has taken the car keys with him. I reach out my hand to depress the door lock, but there isn't one. I scan the dashboard of the unfamiliar rental car. There must be a button that locks all the doors, but I can't see it. There are air conditioning controls, dials to make the car hotter or cooler, switches to bring the windows up or down. There are endless controls for the sound system, settings for CD, for cassette, for more volume, for less. I am scrabbling around now, my son fallen off the breast, and he is wailing, a high-pitched note of dismay, aghast at the interruption. And the men have seen my panic, seen my problem. And now they are running, and I have no idea what they want. Money, car, baby, woman. But I don't want to find out. I don't need to know the answer to that question, because maybe they don't even know themselves. Maybe they're just ready to react and exploit whatever they'll find here. Still, I fumble over the car controls. Still, my son yells. Still, the men come, bearing down on us. Just as they reach the outermost point of the car, so close they could put out their hands and touch the curve of the bonnet, my fingers find, down near the door handle, on the driver's side, a button with the symbol of a padlock. There is a deep, chiming clunk from all five doors of the car. Locked.
The men reach the car. They yank at the doors front and back. They flatten their palms against the window. They peer in at me, sitting there, one breast exposed, a flailing baby in my arms. The car rocks from side to side, but I continue to sit, contained, safe, moated inside metal and glass. I look into their eyes. Wild they are, and blue as the cold, cold sea. I look at the striating lines of their palms, pressed white to the windows. I am panting. They are panting. One slaps the roof in frustration, in fury. It produces a low note like that of a bassoon. Then they leave, walk away, rejoining each other at the far end of the car, drifting over the road, melting back into the stalks of maize. Lungs, 2010. As soon as the water gets too deep for my son, I take him on my back and we half wade, half swim in tandem, him gripping my shoulders with his small hands. We are wading out to a platform some distance from the shore. Another guest at the hotel told us it was easily walkable. My son and I have been sitting on this African beach, in the shade of a palm tree, all morning, and now the baby is asleep on a towel, watched over by my husband. So my son and I have gone on this aquatic adventure. I am here to write a travel piece about sustainable tourism in East Africa. We have flown into Tanzania, seeing the white summit of Kilimanjaro piercing up through the thick fleece of clouds. We have taken a small rattling plane to land on a strip of road between banana trees on Zanzibar. We have walked through spice forests in leech-proof socks, slept in rush-woven huts, climbed the zigzagging steps of a lighthouse on an uninhabited island, searched the vegetation for a rare and reclusive species of deer. This press trip ends with two incongruous days at a resort hotel, a place more luxurious, more lavish, than anything I have ever seen before. Not a great deal of sustainability to be found here. Men in white jackets rise at dawn to rake the seaweed off the sand. Dried leaves are removed from trees with something that looks like a vacuum cleaner. If you sit on a chair, someone materializes at your side with a tray of cool drinks. If your gaze happens to fall on the azure water of the pool, you will be offered a towel. Things happen around you unseen, as if benign and house-proud poltergeists are at work. Fresh flowers appear at your bed. Your hand towels assume the shape of a swan. Your clothes are rehung, refolded, rearranged. My son cannot believe it, and neither can I. I spend a great deal of time thanking people for tasks I wouldn't expect anyone to perform for themselves, let alone on my behalf. It is a relief to be in the sea. No one is in danger of rushing towards me with an ice bucket, a finger bowl, a complimentary tray of handmade chocolates. No one is trying to clean the sea. The water is a clear turquoise, the sand white. Shoals of tiny fish arrow and tack around my legs. First one way, then the other. The platform bobs before us, tantalizing, almost airborne. I didn't fly in an aeroplane until I was in my last year at school, when I went on a Latin class trip to Italy. Arriving in Rome, aged 17, was like receiving a blood transfusion. On the bus from the airport, I was assailed, astonished by the colours of the city, the pale ochre stones of the buildings, the relentless blue of the sky, the green scooters, the tarnished gold of the coins, the black hair of the men who gestured at us as we stared out of the bus window, smacking their lips. Mesmerizing to me were the plates of spaghetti and basil, the baskets of saltless bread, the strange lumpy pillows, the shutters over the windows, the noise of car horns, the clitter-clatter of street crossings, and the plush-vowed language with its arpeggio dips and peaks. The Spanish steps, the fountain in the shape of a boat, the pink house where the poet died, the shape of the Colosseum, like an orthodontist's cast of a mouth. I had never seen anything like it. I loved it all to the point of pain. I was dumbstruck, on the constant verge of tears, devastated by the idea that I would have to go home at the end of the week, and this place, these piazzas, these lives, would carry on without me. I wanted to see everything, go everywhere, never to return home. We were taken around Rome and then to Pompeii, where I put my hand to the groove in a 2,000-year-old drinking fountain, worn smooth by long-dead people leaning into the jet of water, seeking to slake their thirst. We were let loose among the winding paths of Capri. We climbed to the smouldering summit of Vesuvius, in mostly unsuitable footwear, the gummed edges of my shoes hoarding grains of volcanic ash. I would find them later at home, scattered across the carpet of my bedroom. I would pick them up, carefully, obsessively saving them in a glass jar. My own piece of Italy. That school trip not only fed but gave a focus to the restlessness I'd felt all my life. At last I had found a way to satisfy it, to meet it. At last I understood it. It had baffled and confounded me for years, the dissatisfaction, the constraint of the everyday, the tedium and scratchiness of routine, the irritating prickle of sameness. When Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was read to me, and Alice sighs, "Oh, how I long to run away from normal days. I want to run wild with my imagination." I remember rising up from my pillow and thinking, yes, yes, that's it exactly. The school trip showed me that it was possible to ease this longing, to sate it. All I had to do was travel. After he had sailed around the Mediterranean in 1869, Mark Twain said that travel was fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Neuroscientists have been trying for years to pin down what it is about travel that alters us, how it affects mental change. Neural pathways become ingrained, automatic, if they operate only by habit. They are highly attuned to alterations, to novelty. New sights, sounds, languages, tastes, smells stimulate different synapses in the brain, different message routes, different webs of connection, increasing our neuroplasticity. Our brains have evolved to notice differences in our environment. It's how we're alerted to predators, to potential danger. To be sensitive to change, then, is to ensure survival. Professor Adam Galinsky, an American social psychologist who has studied the connection between creativity and international travel, says that foreign experiences increase both cognitive flexibility and depth, and integrativeness of thought, the ability to make deep connections between disparate forms. I sensed this at an instinctive level, age 17. That unassailable flood of novelty, the stimulus of uncharted territory, the overload of the unfamiliar, with all synapses firing, connecting, signalling, burning new pathways. I have never forgotten that bus ride from the airport into the centre of Rome, my first sighting of the city, and I have never lost the thrill of travel. I still crave the mental and physical jolt of being somewhere new, of descending aeroplane steps into a different climate, different faces, different languages. It's the only thing, besides writing, that can meet and relieve my ever-simmering, ever-present restlessness. If I have been too long at home, stuck in the routine of school runs, packed lunches, swimming lessons, laundry, tidying, I begin to pace the house in the evenings. I might start to cook something complicated very late at night. I might rearrange my collections of Scandinavian glass. I will scan the bookshelves, sighing, searching for something I haven't yet read. I will start sorting through my clothes, deciding on impulse to take armfuls to the charity shop. I am desperate for change, endlessly seeking novelty wherever I can find it. My husband might return from an evening out to discover that I have moved all the furniture in the living room. I am not, at times like this, easy to live with. He will raise his eyebrows as I single-handedly shove the sofa towards the opposite wall, just to see how it might look. "Maybe," he will say, as he unlaces his shoes, "we should book a holiday." Ever since that school trip, I have travelled as much as I can whenever time and money allow. I was determined that having babies would not change that. I wanted to bring up my children to be travellers, to be curious about the world, to experience other cultures, other places, other sights. I would, I was sure, strap them onto me and off we'd go. My son was a tiny baby when he first flew in an aeroplane. He was 1 and a half when I took him to live in Italy, where everyone assumed he was a girl because of his red coat and yellow curls. This trip, aged 7, is his first outside Europe. We are still making our way to the platform, which doesn't seem to be getting much closer, and we are talking about the line of breaking waves that we can see in the distance.